now, just again, just to orient ourselves again, we basically finished Perek Dalet. So just another 27 seconds to go, and
we will finish. But I was going through verses a little later on that are connected, and the very last thing we were looking at, you'll recall, is a pasuk all the way in chapter 26 in Perek Perek Chafei, chapter 25. And again, I want to add something from the Vilna Gaon. This is a very famous verse. Perek Chafei, Pasuk Chaf Aleph, and Chaf Beis. And if you recall, this is the Pasuk that says, if your enemy is hungry, feed him bread. And if your enemy is thirsty, give him water to drink. Because you are pouring hot coals on his head, and God will give you reward for what you're doing. Now, the simple meaning of the pasuk seems to be almost having your cake and eat it too, meaning you get the best revenge on your enemy by treating him good, because then he's so embarrassed, and God's going to reward you for all the good deeds that you're doing. That is the simple meaning, but once again, it's hardly possible that Shlomo HaMelech would endorse the concept of this type of revenge, when they say the best revenge is treating your enemy nicely, because first of all, that is a violation of the Torah, which the Torah prohibits not only taking revenge, but the Torah prohibits bearing a grudge, lo sitor, and lo sitor refers to exactly this situation, where you say to the guy, oh, I'm not as bad as you, I'm gonna give you a chesed, because I'm not as bad as you. You make the person feel humiliated. So because of this, the Vilna Gaon understands that this pasuk is allegorical, and sonecha refers to the Yetzer Hara that tries to destroy you and tries to take you away from God. He is your enemy, even if he comes in the guise of friendship, by saying, oh, I'll give you a good life and a nice life and a comfortable life. But that is your ultimate enemy. And the first idea of the pasuk is, use your Yetzer Hara in serving HaKadosh Baruch Hu. Meaning to say, this is the idea of doing mitzvos and learning Torah, even not lishma. So if you're doing, you know, let's assume, for example, you have a Yetzer Hara to be honored, to be recognized, for kavod. So use that Yetzer Hara to motivate you to do mitzvos. And even though, ultimately, mitzvos should be done for the sake of HaKadosh Baruch Hu, but Chazal give us a promise, mitoch shelo lishma, ba lishma, with the one proviso that the Vilna Gaon himself says, that the rule that when you do things shelo lishma, it will eventually bring you to lishma, is only if you have a desire to eventually be lishma. Meaning, you could say, right now, I do have this Yetzer Hara for honor, for recognition, for ego gratification. But I would wish and I would hope that I could get beyond it and serve Hashem l'shem shemayim. That is the promise that Chazal give us. Mitoch shelo lishma, ba lishma. Right? So that's a very important idea. Use your negatives as a motivating force in life. Because when you simply try to ignore the negatives in your personality, it may come back with a lot of ferocity. But if you use the negatives as a motivator, then the Yetzer Hara feels you're conceding to it. And once you're conceding to it, the Yetzer Hara will not be as intense and not as strong. This is what Rav Dessler calls a shochad l'satan. There is a concept of bribing the satan. You concede something to the satan. Shochad, bribe. Shochad, we talked about shochad. L'satan. A bribe to the satan. In fact, Rav Dessler says, this is actually the psychological meaning of the very mystical institution of the scapegoat on Yom Kippur, right? On Yom Kippur, the most difficult offering to understand is the Sa'ir HaMishtaleach. The Sa'ir HaMishtaleach is the scapegoat. Literally, that's where you get the English phrase, where the Kohen confesses, Kohen Gadol confesses the sins of all of the Jewish people on this goat. And this goat is not a korban. The goat is taken out to the Judean desert, and it is pushed off a mountain, and the goat dies, and when the goat dies, there was a miracle that the scarlet thread of chet that was hanging in the Beis HaMikdash turns white as a sign of divine. And in the Torah, the scapegoat, the word so'ir ha-mishtaleach, which is a very, very parav term, that's a goat that is sent away, that is a mishnayic term. That is not what the Torah calls it. The Torah calls the goat so'ir la'azazel. And Chazal didn't want to use that term because it could be misunderstood. Azazel refers to the demons that are said to inhabit deserts and uninhabited areas. So, literally, so'ir la'azazel, literally, means the goat that is sacrificed to the demons of the desert. Now you understand why Chazal did not even want to use that term, because God forbid it could connote the idea of sacrifices to demonic forces. So they used a more parav word, so'ir ha-mishtaleach, the goat that's sent out into the desert. But you can't deny, the Torah calls it so'ir la'azazel. Now, in modern Hebrew, Azazel refers to hell and the like, so they say Lech Lazazel, whatever. I mean, it's a nice thing that even the profanity in Israel has a makor in the Chumash. So yeah, there's actually something comforting about that in some ways. But okay, so the Ramban explains the following. The Ramban explains the idea the following way. He said that imagine a king. And you needed to have an audience with the king. But there are vicious guard dogs that destroy anybody that's trying to approach the king. So you won't be able to approach the king. So what does, in fact, burglars do this all the time. A burglar has a nice piece of steak, raw meat. And as the dogs run after him, he throws the meat to the dog. And that distracts the vicious dog. And therefore you're able to reach the king, or in the case of the burglar, rob the house. So the Ramban says, so too on Yom Kippur, we desperately want an audience with God. We know that if we just get into Hashem, He's going to forgive us. But there are powerful, demonic, negative forces that prevent us from entering the king's palace. So the so'ir mishtaleach is the raw meat that you give to the demonic forces. The Ramban himself uses the Lashon, in fact, Rav Dessler's words are actually the Ramban's words, Shochad L'Satan. But the question is, the Ramban's explanation is not really a full explanation, because that still means you're bringing a sacrifice to the demons to let you alone. So Rav Dessler explains in psychological terms that the So'ir HaMishtaleach is kind of a metaphor for the idea that sometimes to approach God, you have to give a bribe to the negative forces within you. Meaning psychologically, exactly this, that you do a mitzvah through kavod or ego or whatever it would be. You see, so that's the idea of a shochad le'satan. Okay, and the Vilna Gaon reads it into this verse. That's what it means. Give your enemy bread, which is Torah, and water, which is Torah. Now, to take the bread and the water metaphor a little further, bread refers to halachos, basic halacha. That is the bread of life. That keeps us alive. Water refers to the agada, that draws a person's heart to Hashem just as water flows from its source. And therefore it's agada and halacha. Now, I think we more or less said this last week, but now I want to take it a little further. And you'll notice that there are many, many metaphors for different parts of Torah throughout the book of Mishlei according to the Gra's interpretation. Basic halacha, in other words, the how to do, you know, how to live as a Jew, in some places is described as bread. Other places it's described as fire. Agada, which are the ethical, moralistic, and even Kabbalistic teachings of Judaism, the spirit, is sometimes described as wine, sometimes described as water. So on the halacha side, we have bread and fire. On the agada side, we have water and wine. Do you remember that was the meaning of the teaching? Chazal say, until the age of 40, eating is better than drinking. After the age 40, drinking is better than eating. So the Vilna Gaon says, this is not a diet recommendation, but this is referring to the notion that, you know, until you reach 40, one's main occupation should be to understand the practical details of living a Jewish life. When you hit 40, which is the age of understanding, right, so those of you that have hit 40 have reached a very important milestone, the age of Bina, as it were. So at that point, one's heart is ready to be open to the more philosophical, more mystical ideas. Okay. So now, here the Vilna Gaon has one unusual twist that takes it even further. The Vilna Gaon says there are two primary Yetzer Haras within the human being. There is the Yetzer Hara that he calls the Kasani. Kas. Kaasani. The Yetzer Hara of anger. Although we'll see that anger includes many things besides anger. And then there's the Yetzer Hara Hatavani. Ta'ava is lust. Lust. Now, the way we understand it is this. Let me take the second one first. That's a little easier to understand. The Yetzer Hara of Tava is the Yetzer Hara in my life that seeks ease, relaxation, comfort, pleasure, laziness. All of those are associated with the Tavani, in which I want a life of no little or no responsibility, in which I just get to do what I want. That's Tavani. And the Vilna Gaon describes Tavani as primarily a passive impulse. Again, we don't always talk that way. You talk about Taiva, you're about Taiva. The Vilna Gaon defines Tavani as kind of the person who's so lazy, he doesn't even get out of his home to indulge in his lusts. He kind of does everything at home. Unfortunately, with internet and other things, this is a lot easier than it used to be. But he sits at home, watches soap operas, whatever they watch. That is what we call the tavani. I just want a life of ease. No problems. Kasani, anger, is not just anger, although obviously the primary manifestation of kasani is kas, but kasani is more of a function of the egotism, in which I want to have control over the world, control over people, control over possessions. So the person, as it were, who kind of is a very ambitious businessman, who wants to gain and amass money, in the Vilna Gaon's lexicon, we would not call him acting out of the koach of tavani. It's a little bit of an unusual usage. We would call it acting out of the koach of kasani, because the notion of egotism, in which I want power, and I will work hard to get my power, I will work extraordinarily hard to get power and domination, that connects to kas. Because what is kas? What is anger? Anger is the frustration I have that somebody is taking something that belongs to me. Now that could be my possessions, it could be he doesn't respect me enough, so I get angry because he is not giving me my due. Right? So, all of that is kasani. So here's the Vilna Gaon's very interesting chiddush. Torah helps us combat our Yetzer Hara. But he says, the Yetzer Hara of kasani is overcome by halacha, and the Yetzer Hara of tavani is overcome by agada. Now, why is that so? If you have children or husbands that go to a base medrash, go to Gemara Shiurim or learn Gemara, etc., you know that often the pitch is pretty loud and aggressive. Learning halacha is a fairly aggressive enterprise. A lot of testosterone. People shout, people yell. People sometimes knock over tables. This is called rischa d'oraisa, the turbulence of the Torah. It's a way of displacing aggression in a positive way. So the Vilna Gaon says, the koach of kasani, that is anger, that seeks control, that expresses ego, can be sublimated and directed in a positive way to the pupil of Talmudic dialectic and the like. That is why he says that if basic halachic understanding is called bread, it's also called fire. Because fire is connected spiritually to the koach of anger. And when you take that anger, that excitement, even that egotism, and you channel it in the learning halacha, you're taking the negative fire and turning it into positive fire. Right? That's called Eish. Limud of Gemara, of halacha, in depth, is called the Koach of Eish. Now, Tavani is a very different problem. Tavani is the notion of laziness, comfort, hedonism, pleasure seeking. That comes from a certain sense of a deadness of spirit, because one does not appreciate the beauty of the spiritual life. Even if one is religious, one may go through motions, but one does not see a larger picture of beauty and nobility. Agada, including Kabbalah, gives a person a sense of vision, a sense of beauty. And when you have that sense of beauty, that motivates you to seek that beauty, as opposed to simply retiring from the work of life. And therefore, he says, Agada is compared to water, because water, in the negative sense, is hedonism, relaxation, like you're sitting in the jacuzzi, or whatever it would be. And the Agada is the good water. It takes the water, as it were, and it turns it into the pleasure of a spiritual life. So, therefore, the Vilna Gaon says, it's very... that here it says bread and water, so it doesn't say fire and water, but the Vilna Gaon shows that the bread is also referred to as fire. In other words, the halachic Torah learning, and therefore he says that halachic learning in depth is a sublimation of the koach of kasani, and agadic learning is a sublimation of the koach of the tavani. Again, a very, very interesting idea, that it'll often be the agadata that will give a person a pleasure in the spiritual world, and that pleasure will take the place of the hedonism of taiva. Now, here, let me just mention something. You may have heard this before. I may have mentioned it before. A number of years ago, there was a woman, a reporter, a very good writer, Ellen Willis, and I believe that she died. She died a few years ago. But Ellen Willis was a freelance journalist, and she had she grew up an assimilated, secular Jew in Queens, and her brother, who actually is a Rebbe in Yeshiva now, but her brother became a Baal Tshuva, and she was very curious, because she was very close to her brother, and she couldn't understand how a rational 22-year-old person could become a religious Jew. So she came to Jerusalem trying to explore this. Now, Rolling Stone magazine, of all places, which normally writes about drug cultures, maybe they thought there was some drugs involved or some cult involved. So they kind of commissioned her to write an article exposing the seamy side of the Baal Tshuva world. This is the 1980s, the early 1980s. And, you know, they gave her like unlimited pages. I'm jealous, you know. I write for magazines sometimes. They're like, no more than 2 pages, you know. Gotta cut everything. But they said she has as many pages as she wants. So I remember I was in Chicago then, and we really, really wanted to read it. We heard about this article. Now it's online. There was no internet in those days. But we heard about this article, and we really wanted to read it because it was very Nogaya, you know, the world of Kirov and the like. But you know, it looks embarrassing. You know, you go into a 7-Eleven, you buy a Rolling Stone magazine. So I know one of the rabbis in Chicago. He made a point. He waited Motzei Shabbos till 2:30 in the morning to buy this Rolling Stone. Nobody would be around. And of course, just as he's buying the Rolling Stone, his Shabbos guest, you know, comes in and says, "Oh, now I know what you rabbis read when you're off duty," you know, whatever. But it's really quite a remarkable article, because she was a great writer, a very sensitive person. And she describes talking to her brother and all the different things. And she describes a few meetings with Rav Noach Weinberg, Zichrono Livracha. Really, he's an extraordinary, one of the great, great people in Kiruv Rechokim, bringing Jews back to Judaism. A very extraordinarily persuasive person. And in fact, it was so interesting that you really get the sense that she was on the verge of making this commitment. And you're waiting, you're reading the article with bated breath, because she's agonizing over this. The last minute, she pulls herself away. Maybe I shouldn't call this from the cliff. Maybe that's not the right way of describing it. The last minute, she couldn't make the break. But she really was agonizing and struggling. So she recounts in this article that she had a conversation with Rabbi Weinberg, and Rabbi Weinberg asked her, "What is it that human beings value above everything?" And she said right away, "Human beings value pleasure." Now, he didn't call her a hedonist. He didn't call her a, whatever. He said, "I agree with you. Human beings value pleasure. Now, tell me, what is the opposite of pleasure?" So she said, "The opposite of pleasure is pain. We seek pleasure and we avoid pain." He said, "Nope, that's not the opposite of pleasure. The opposite of pleasure is comfort." So she said she didn't understand. Pleasure, comfort, they seem to be synonyms. They seem to be kind of the same. He said, "Nope." He says, "All pleasure comes from pain. Comfort is when you don't want to go through the pain." He gave an example, even a sports example, you know, a trivial example. Let's say, you know, like you have somebody who wants to get on the basketball team in high school, American high school. So they get up, you know, they're not naturally a great player, so they get up every morning, 6 o'clock in the morning. They practice 2 hours before school. And, you know, they don't go out at night, they don't have any social activities or whatever it is. And they work very, very hard, and there's a lot of pain and a lot of difficulty. But they achieve something that's important to them. That's called pleasure. The pleasure that comes after pain. Comfort is when you never bother to get out of bed. And think about, you know, think about these Olympic gymnasts, you know, they start, they practice, you know, more than that. 5 hours a day, 5 o'clock, you know, and years and years and years they do this. So Rabbi Weinberg said, Judaism is not about comfort. Judaism is a very uncomfortable religion. You got to do a lot. You don't always fit in, although Baruch Hashem, where we are, you know, we're Zocha, to be able to fit in a lot better. But still, a lot of work, a lot of effort, a lot of struggle. But what Judaism gives us is the pleasure of living a life that was worthwhile, living a life of purpose. He says, look for the pleasure, don't look for the comfort. And same thing, by the way, in marriage, same thing, in raising children. The more we invest, the more pain we have. I don't mean in a negative sense, but the more we go through, the more we've created, the more we build, as it were. So, the Vilna Gaon's point that the learning of Haggadah is a curative for Taiva, that is because Haggadah, which gives you the spirit of Judaism, the values of Judaism, the hashkafa of Judaism. Again, Haggadah includes many things. Midrashim, and it includes Kabbalah, it includes the overall philosophy of Judaism. Haggadah is actually a very, very broad term. Anything beyond the how-tos, anything beyond the halacha lemaisa. Haggadah switches your focus from comfort to pleasure. And that is why it overcomes the natural inertia and laziness that can often pull us down, which the Vilna Gaon described as the koach hatavani. Because when a person sees the sweetness and goodness of Torah, they simply lose their desire for that which is trivial. It's like growing up, like not playing with children's games anymore. The other stuff is like a child's game. You know, they tell the story about one of the great Gedolim in the time of the Vilna Gaon, not the Vilna Gaon. This is the Shagas Aryeh. Shagas Aryeh was actually a phenomenally great Gedol. In fact, the Vilna Gaon himself said about the Shagas Aryeh that in Kabbalah, the Vilna Gaon held he was one and the Shagas Aryeh was second in the generation. In Halacha, he actually held the Shagas Aryeh was number one. I mean, that's a very, very, very amazing statement. But the Shagas Aryeh had a difficult life. He was often fired. He was very strict and as a Rav. And if the Gila didn't like his Pesachim, he often had to move from place to place, although he was one of the, indeed, with the Vilna Gaon, the greatest Gadol of the... So it shows no matter how great you are, you can be persecuted and driven away. He was also a very independent Gadol. He would often argue on earlier generations. In fact, there is a legend. It may be a legend. I'm not really sure. That the way he died was his bookcase fell on him. So all of the Svarim fell on him. And it was said that this was a revenge of the Svarim, although I guess Svarim shouldn't commit revenge either, because he argued on so many of them. You know, they kind of, you know, hit him back. So anyway, as it is recorded, that as he was leaving the world, he was spending his final moments, he wanted to learn Shas one more time, just to have a final review. So he was, he took a Gemara, or somebody held a Gemara, and he was just turning the pages, just to read through it one more time. So, in Lithuania of those days, people were very, very tough. So somebody went over to him and said, you know, you're about to die, maybe you should say Vidoy right now, confess your Averis. They were really, you know, pretty tough. The Litvaks were tough people. He said, you know, say Vidoy, say Al-Khay. It's not a time to learn. So the Shagas Aryeh is said to have responded that it's not that he's such a tzaddik that he never committed a sin. He says he has a Yetzirah, but he says he just never had time to do sins. He says, I just didn't have time. And that's a very interesting idea, because what that's reflecting is it's not so much that he was consciously avoiding all of these temptations, but when you fill your life with meaningful, good experiences, there just is less time. You know, an adult does not make a self-conscious decision that I'm not going to play with marbles or Jack or whatever it would be. It's not like, I am deciding through my Bechira that I'm not going to do this childish game. It kind of just happens, you know, naturally. As you're doing other things, you're not doing that anymore. So, in many, many ways, you struggle with evil, not by struggling with evil, but by simply filling up your time with good. The metaphor that's given is darkness, right? You don't dispel darkness by taking a baseball bat and hitting the darkness. You dispel the darkness by turning on the light. So that is what the Gra says, that the koach of taiva, which is inertia, laziness, comfort, ease, which is all a very, very natural part of the human personality, as it were. With Agada, you get a vision of the pleasure that is so much greater. So then, mimela, automatically, you're less connected to that world of inertia and laziness. So that's the Gra's chiddush in this pasuk, that the halachic portions are called fire and are called bread. The agadic portions are called water and wine. Now, why the water and the wine is not given such a deep explanation. I mean, on one hand, water is because just as a river moves and it keeps on moving, so too the agada is moshech your lev. It pulls your heart to seek greater closeness to God. Why it's called wine is, of course, you know, actually Purim is coming up, obviously. So we think about the great power of wine. But what do Chazal say about wine? Nichnas yayin. When wine comes into the body, yatsa sod, secrets come out of the body. What that means is, because the gematria of yayin is 70, and the gematria of sod is 70. When 170 comes in, the other 70 comes out. And literally, of course, it's absolutely the case. A person starts talking when they're alcoholic, as it were. But in a more deeper way, the Vilna Gaon explains, again, with the metaphor, that just like Yayin brings out the secrets, when you learn the Agadah and the Medrash, you will understand the secrets of the Torah, as it were. So, Nichnas Yayin, Yatsa Sodya.
Did you say that Tavani is anything beyond the Halakha?
No, Tavani.
Tavani is lust, right? Tavani means lust.
Right.
And lust is the desire of the human being for laziness, ease, inertia, comfort, and hedonism.
Okay.
So that is addressed by Agada, because the Agada gives us a vision of life that can be filled with meaningful pleasure. So at that point, we will leave as childish the preoccupation with Tavani to seek a higher role. Right? So therefore, the Agada learning helps us overcome the Tavani.
That's what I want to know. What's Agada learning?
Agada is that portion that's not halacha. That's correct. So Agada includes Midrashim. It includes the philosophy of Judaism. It includes the mystical aspects of Judaism. That is what Agada is.
Okay.
Yeah. Because it's an explicit. Oh, Kigachon Tamachon. Yeah. Well, no. So Vilna Gaon says that the Yetzer Hara will let you do these things, because the Yetzer Hara thinks you're serving it. But in reality, you're burning it up, because mitoch shelo lishma balishma. Right? Ki gachalim atachot al rosho, meaning in the course of the Yetzer Hara thinking you're serving it, you're actually destroying it. You're burning it up. And Hashem will then give you reward, because mitoch shelo lishma balishma means when you finally reach lishma, you will get reward for all of the lo lishma that you did. Hashem Yashlim Lach, he will give you reward for all of the shalom lishma that you did. Right? That's how the Gra understands the verse. So the truth of the matter is, you know, this is something that we need to pay attention to, because, you know, in the standard yeshiva curriculum, now I'm talking about maybe an older yeshiva, you know, the emphasis is almost 100% on the halachic portions of the Gemara. And although for many, many boys, Baruch Hashem, that's a source of great, great joy, but for some, they dry up, so to speak. Meaning to say, they need something that feeds enthusiasm and cheshek and joy in Avodas Hashem. And the Vilna Gaon is telling us exactly, and the Vilna Gaon was, of course, then paralleled in his halachic mastery, the Vilna Gaon tells us exactly that it is through Agada and Medrash, and today we could augment it with Chassidus, which is really, Chassidus is really a branch of Agada in that sense, that one gets inspiration. One gets, as it were, in fact, another muscle that's often used is, Halacha is the body of Judaism, the guf. And Agada is the neshama, that's another muscle that is often used. And a guf without a neshama is dead! On the other hand, a neshama without a guf is not capable of functioning. Halacha is the key to how we function, but agada is the life that is given to the body. Well, the truth of the matter is, I don't want to over-exaggerate this. I mean, there are indeed many great yeshivas that do incorporate some. Now, Hasidic yeshivas do much more, because Hasidic yeshivas have hours devoted to Hasidus and the like. A Chabad yeshiva, for example, will have 2 or 3 hours a day of Hasidus, but a regular Litvishi yeshiva certainly does not, but they will have chaburos, they will have people like Moshe Shapiro, for example. He should be well, goes to many yeshivas to give brilliant shiurim in Agadata and the like. But, you know, why don't we do it more? Well, part of it is because, you know, that's a special talent. Many Rebbeim are not necessarily able to teach Agadata in an inspiring, deep level. It's a chisaron. In fact, what happens often is when you're learning Gemara, and the Gemara itself will interrupt a halachic discussion to have several pages of Agadata, the Rebbe will often skip it. He says, we're going to skip the next two pages. Just skip it. That's what happens. But in many, many ways, I mean, I don't want to overgeneralize, but even phenomenon like kids at risk, I understand it's a much more complicated problem than that. But the notion of kids dropping out is because they don't have an enthusiasm and a passion and a love for Yiddishkeit. And it is the Gra is telling us, it is the Agada and the Medrash that can give a person that love. Yeah.
The same says till 40 and after 40 is only based if it's after the Hanukkah.
Well, again, it is true. You're right. But again, let me point out that the Gemara that the Gra uses for the 40, it does not say just eat and don't drink. It says before 40, you should have more eating than drinking. After 40, more drinking than eating. So, you're right. So nobody is saying we should spend 2/3 of the day on Agada. So, the Iker has to be halacha. But just like if you ate bread without water, it would be hard to digest, right? So it's mamash the same situation. So we need Agada. By the way, it's brought down in many Svarim that Shabbos in particular is mesugal for Agadata. That Agadata, whether it's Kabbalah, if you're holding there, or it's Midrashim, or Ein Yaakov, Shabbos in particular, the heart is more open to the inyanim of Agadata. Now I know what happened basically in the yeshiva world, there's a little bit, you might call it a mini revolution, I'm not going to say it's an absolutely major revolution, and that is Chassidus has become more integrated in non-Hasidic yeshivas. So, for example, in many yeshivas, at least individuals, will learn svarim like the Sfas Emes, like Reb Tzadok. Those are harder svarim. Many people like the Slonim Rebbe's svarim, the Nesiva Shalom, which are much easier svarim. The Or Gedaliah of Gedaliah Shor, who was a Litvish Rosh Yeshiva with a strong Hasidic background. People like the Or Gedaliah. It's kind of Hasidus for Litvaks. I even see people learning Tanya, and some do the Rav Nachman Breslov, the Likutei Maharan, and the like. And the truth is, this was a recent phenomenon. This is a relatively recent phenomenon, meaning it used to be that in non-Hasidic yeshivas, you did not bring in a Hasidic sefer. The person that is credited with kind of bringing Hasidus into the olam of non-Hasidic yeshivas is actually Reb Tesler, the Michtav Meliyo, who came from England, and he became the Mashgiach in Panovich, right? Reb Tesler, Meliyo Tesler. This was in the 1940s and 50s. He was very connected to Sifrei Hasidus. If you look at the Michtav Meliyo, he'll bring the Tanya in, he'll bring in the Sfas Emes, he'll bring in Reb Tzadok. And that was not the heritage. You know, he was a Talmud of Kelim, where we saw Salanter. And that was pure Musar. That was pure Musar. Again, very important, but it was not a Hasidic type of Musar. And some of his old Chaverim, like Rav Chaska Levenstein, who became Mashgiach, he succeeded Rav Dessler. But he used to come and listen to the Shmuzim, and they wanted to check him out. They thought this was a little heretical, this was a little chutz l'machaneh. Hasidus didn't have a makom in Kelim, etc. But Rav Dessler felt it was a tzorech hasha'ah. It was something that the generation needed. They needed a certain type of emotional inspiration, and this would ignite their hearts. So the truth of the matter is that to whatever degree, I wouldn't call it a major revolution, but to whatever degree Hasidus is accepted, at least some Hasidus shesvarim, as they say, it's mainly Rav Tzadok, Sfas Emes, and Nesiva Shalom, some say Tanya as well. Not everything, but those are kind of the ones that are there. Likutei Maran, perhaps. It's really Rav Dessler did this. In fact, it's interesting. Rav Dessler actually had a machlokas about how to interpret the Tanya with the Lubavitcher Rebbe, of all people. It's very interesting, the exchange of letters. You know, just to digress for a moment. You know, the Velt says, people assume, that one of the Vilna Gaon's main problems with the Hasidic movement, right? The Vilna Gaon was a fighter against Hasidus, and there were many, many separate issues. But the esoteric issue, a very esoteric issue that some consider to be the most important, is over the question of defining a term in the Kabbalah of the Arizal. And the Arizal developed an idea that is called Tzimtzum. Tzimtzum means contraction or withdrawal. And the Ari basically starts off with a very fundamental question. If Hashem is everywhere, then how can I be here? Can't have two objects in the same space. Where is God? There's a table here, a lectern. Where is God? So the Ari said, it sounds deceptively simple, but volumes and volumes and volumes are written on this. The Ari said, well, in order to allow a world to exist, God had to contract into himself and make room. He made an empty space by contracting, and that's how the world exists. So the Baal HaTanya says, that's not possible. It's not possible to say that there's no God here. There has to be God here, because there's no place where there's no God. And therefore, he says, Tzimtzum is kavyachol. Tzimtzum is a mashal. It is a metaphor. It is not a reality. In reality, Tzimtzum didn't really happen. Hashem is here. Now, it is said that the Vilna Gaon considered that to be paganism or pantheism and idolatry, because you're saying God is in the table. God is in the chair. I'm God. And therefore, the Vilna Gaon espouses the idea of what is called Tzimtzum Kipeshuto. Tzimtzum has to be understood in the most literal level. Now, this may sound like a very, very esoteric machlokas, and indeed, we don't really understand what the issue even is, but many say that this was the single most important issue. Because the Vilna Gaon held that certain beliefs regarding Tzimtzum are avodah zarah, are pantheism. To say God is in the tree, God is in the rock, God is keeping it alive, of course we say that, but you can't say God is here. All right. So, Rav Dessler learns both the writings of the Nefesh HaChaim, which is the Vilna Gaon's disciple, Rav Volozhiner, and all of the Chabad writings. And Rav Dessler came to the maskana that although the vocabularies were different, but fundamentally, both are in agreement. Meaning, he wanted to say, there is no real machlokas, it was simply a question of different words being used, but in substance, they were the same. And in that way, he was being matzil, as it were, chassidus from the Vilna Gaon's accusations, and the like. So, Lubavitcher Rebbe wrote, who had just become Rebbe, Lubavitcher Rebbe wrote Rav Dessler a very, very long letter. There is absolutely a machlokas, and these are different schools of thought, and you have to understand that there is a machlokas, there is a fundamental difference, and you don't try to bridge the gap. Recently, somebody published a big, massive, two-volume translation of the Nefesh HaChaim, Rav Chaim Volozhiner's book on Kabbalah, with a huge introduction. In fact, the reason it's two volumes is because volume one is basically an introduction. And he revisits this whole issue of Tzimtzum, going over all the different opinions. What the modern Kabbalists say, is it Tzimtzum Kipshuto, or Tzimtzum is a mashal, and the like. And he wants to conclude that the consensus of the modern Mekubalim is like Rav Dessler, that in fact there is no machlokas. But again, I don't know, what can I say? I mean, obviously, let me put it this way. I think anyone that says there's no machlokas is faced with a huge problem, because the Vilna Gaon apparently thought that there was a machlokas. So, what are we saying? Are we saying the Vilna Gaon misunderstood? I mean, it's a very difficult thing to say, you know, there's no machlokas. The Vilna Gaon said there was a machlokas. So, in a sense, Lubavitcher Rebbe is supported by the Vilna Gaon, that there's a machlokas. Okay, but be it as it may, those are very esoteric inyanim that for most of us are not so nogeya. But still, putting that aside, in the yeshiva world, Hasidish Sfarim have come in, particularly because what Hasidus tries to do, there is a relation between Hasidus and Kabbalah. Hasidus, to use maybe a bit of a secular term, psychologizes Kabbalah, meaning it takes the abstract ideas of Kabbalah and it shows how you apply them in your Avodas Hashem. And that's very key. In fact, what is often said is this. The relationship of Kabbalah to Chassidus is like the relationship of anatomy to medicine. Right? Anatomy is describing the structure of the human body. The bones, the muscles, the digestive organs, whatever it would be. But it doesn't tell you what to do with them. It doesn't tell you how to heal them. It doesn't tell you how to strengthen them. It just describes a system. Kabbalah, pure Kabbalah, is an amazingly intricate description of cosmic realities, of the different worlds and the different levels of creation and the different channels, the different arteries and veins through which Shefa, through which divine influences come in and come out. So you have an anatomical description of not just this universe, an anatomical description of the totality of reality in an amazingly complicated way. But what Chassidus tries to do is, okay, I know all of these worlds, I know all of these channels. What does that mean about how I live my life? What do I do with it? And the like. So it psychologizes Kabbalah in the sense of turning it into a derech of avoda. In other words, you'll often see in Chassidus Yisvarim, after it expounds a Kabbalistic teaching, it will then say, Al derech avoda, meaning how does this apply in my avodas Hashem? And they will try to bring it down to earth. That was the great story.
Can you give an example?
It's hard. I would have to give you millions of examples. But you understand that. And think about anatomy and medicine. That's exactly right. That you kind of take it and you apply it to your avodas Hashem. Now, this is why Rabbi Yisrael Salanter himself, who was not a chassid, but he didn't like people to learn Kabbalah, because he said, Kabbalah, you were learning about abstract systems, and you had no sense of how to apply it to your life. You know, Rebbe Yoshev's grandfather, the Baal HaLashem, was really one of the great Kabbalists. Rav Shlomo El Yoshev. He wrote a series of Svarim, very arcane Kabbalah, the Leshem Shavol V'Achlama. I think it's like his 90th Yortzeit, even this week before Purim. There is a story, some people say it didn't happen, but there is a story that he actually met Rabbi Yisrael Salanter. He had a great, great desire to meet Rabbi Yisrael Salanter, but he was afraid of meeting Rabbi Yisrael Salanter, because he thought Rabbi Yisrael Salanter would tell him not to learn Kabbalah. And he had a very strong love and connection and aptitude for Kabbalah. And it is said, Rav Shlomo Salanter said, what difference does it make if there's this world or that world? All I know is that Gehenna is very hot. And if I don't live my life right, it's going to hurt. So he felt that some of the great abstractions of these very, very immensely complicated systems were not always directly helpful to a person, and that's where Chassidus often filled in the gap by psychoanalyzing it, so to speak, into human avoda. Okay, but be it as it may, I guess in terms of Mishlei, the point I wanted to make is that it is Agada that addresses the laziness of the soul, the inertia of the soul, the deadening of the soul, because it gives a person a sense of purpose and a sense of vibrancy. And although you are correct that until the age of 40, a person's learning must be primarily bread, but you also need the water and the wine to take it down. So we'll stop here. I want to wish you all a wonderful, wonderful Purim. You know, it's interesting that some things don't change. Thousands of years ago, there was a guy in Iran that wanted to kill the Jewish people, and I don't know, still happening. Same country, but Be'ezras Hashem, we should have a Yeshua from that enemy as well.